Paula Gordon, Bill Russell, I and he are pleased to be with Harold Holzer. You say the lessons that are to be learned. I don't want to go too far before really thinking about that, because that's, it felt to me like the undercurrent, the backstory of what you were writing here. Yeah. You're really interested in Lincoln, and I don't know that you did it exactly intentionally, but the parallels are just striking.
Yeah. Well, I may put it into an op-ed or something, or drop leaflets. I haven't decided how to do it, but
make sure it's all over the place.
Right. I don't think my website will do it, but we'll see. one of the most obvious things, if you look at the way Lincoln did his inaugural address, is if you're angry, if you're resentful, if your campaign has really exhausted you, get all of your anger out with the first draft of your inaugural address, then tone it down. That's what Lincoln did. He started with a very hot document, and he ended with a beautiful, peaceful yet firm document, as one observer said. Another lesson is, don't say too much too soon. FDR did this too. He wouldn't do a bank holiday with Herbert Hoover. He just waited until he had the power and the authority as well as the spotlight. Pay attention to the symbolism of your cabinet appointments. Today it's all about ethnicity and gender. In Lincoln's day, it was about geography and party antecedents. Before you were a Republican, were you a Democrat or a Whig? Lincoln took that very seriously. He believed in the old adage that a cabinet secretary does you the most good publicly the day you announce him or her today. After that, all you need them to do is be a good bureaucrat, except for Henry Paulson. In whom we trust, because we have no other choice.
The cabinet having to be balanced according to a different set of priorities and criteria. You quote Doris Kearns Goodwin saying that Lincoln, who you just show time and again, knows who he is and trusts himself and is self-reliant, that he understood. You can quote her for me.
Well, I'm not sure which Doris
quote. The strength.
Oh, yes. Doris, that's where we have our little disagreement about the cabinet. As I adore her, and she's been a great supporter of this project in so many ways, which I'd be happy to talk about. But the one thing we disagreed about a bit is how quickly Lincoln assembled this cabinet.
Oh, I don't care about that. It's the strength of Lincoln.
You know why it's important? I'll tell you why. Because it was not a precipitant, automatic selection of his chief opponents, which shows his strength. What it really shows also is his political skill. He was looking for a Southerner. He was trying to get his best friend there and then decided, and there's another lesson, don't take your hometown with you to Washington. Leave it behind. Lincoln left it. He had them on the train, but then the train metaphorically went back home. He didn't have any of his hometown crowd with him. Jimmy Carter might have made that mistake. I shouldn't say
that
in Georgia.
I don't think any question about that.
Lincoln didn't. He was lonely in Washington. He just had his two young private secretaries.
Well, and certainly the Clintons have shown us not to do that.
Yeah.
There are lots of lessons to be learned. Doris Kearns Goodwin says that came to my mind was that he understood that they were all very strong, and he was stronger than all of them.
And he certainly and no one else believed that was so when he came there. Seward met him.
Specifically Seward.
Well, Seward, I loved my stories about the first days, not because I wrote them, because they happened. Seward, comes breathlessly to the train station to meet him and misses him. He's helped arrange the subterfuge coming through Baltimore in secret, and he breathlessly goes to Willard's Hotel. Where am I going to take over? And then he finally gets to Lincoln, and he does take over the schedule. And Lincoln lets him do it. Because he's so calm and so self-confident that it doesn't bother him.
It's important to say Seward. Seward's icebox is all I ever knew about Seward. I mean, he's the guy who bought Alaska, end of subject. Wrong, Paula, wrong. Yeah. Seward was important in this story because, and you say this, what would have happened if Seward had won? And Seward thought he had won, and he thought it was his, and he thought that he could take over.
What would have happened if Seward had said at the last minute, which is what he did, if he had stuck to it, I've changed my mind. If you're going to have Salmon Chase and Simon Cameron in your cabinet, I'm not joining the cabinet. And Lincoln just wouldn't accept it. He just wouldn't accept his withdrawal. And then he put together this fantastic dinner in Washington and invited all the people who he would have named to the cabinet. And that's sort of the first clue that any of them had that they were really in it.
And the press missed it?
Missed the story.
Exactly. Entirely!
Entirely.
What does that tell us?
Plus ça change, I don't know.
Yes.
They can still miss the story.
It happens. It's interesting. It appears, and of course, there's no way of knowing. And actually, it's interesting that, you know, it's not important that you and Doris Kearns Goodwin agree. It's not, I mean, that's part of what we keep wanting to resolve history. Exactly. And these are real people, and they didn't know, probably. Having said that, though, it appears that Lincoln did a masterful job of manipulating Seward from day one, and actually probably before the convention.
Before, because he won.
Well, he won, but John Brown, according to some stories, gets some credit for that.
Well,
but to watch him,
John Brown, abolitionist.
Yes.
Particularly as they come in immediate all-day, everyday contact in Washington, to watch Lincoln just sort of envelop him. And I don't think Seward ever knew he was being enveloped. I don't think he knew he was being controlled. And I'm not sure that Lincoln
did. And when he
did,
he was sort of grateful and admiring. And that's what Doris has done so beautifully.
Yeah.
Give us that idea that Seward was one of the, as important as he was in the party, was one of the first to recognize that Lincoln was a special person and he could do no better for the country or even for himself than just cooperating and pledging his support. And after his one, which I don't write about because it's after the inauguration, after trying to become prime minister, and he was called prime minister during the transition too. The wonderful story is, you know, the notion of having your chief rival as your secretary of state was not a new one. And when Henry Clay was asked to do it, the president had to journey to his home at Ashland to ask him, on bended knee, to join his administration.
Which president was that?
I knew you would ask that.
Well, okay, the president.
The president. I'm pretending you didn't ask.
Fine.
I don't remember. Harrison, maybe?
But he really literally went.
Was an index, I'll see.
Yeah, but while we're... Thurlow Weed, Seward's operative, wanted Lincoln to go to Auburn, New York.
Yeah.
And Lincoln, as they say, Gideon Wells wrote later, he did not play Mr. Harrison, whoever the president was. Yeah. He did not go. Taylor, I think. Maybe not Taylor.
Whomever. The notion.
I'm doing some research. I'm doing some data gathering.
I should have read it.
The kindness, the common sense, the uncommon sense is. Again, I go back to the two, Lincoln and Obama in this case, both being out of Illinois, being frontiermen, having to just make stuff up. I kept thinking about evolution as I read this, that, you know, A, you never know what's going to happen. B, little stuff matters. Mm-hmm. C, nobody springs full-born from the brow of Zeus. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
That all of these pieces, some of this is... You need people who do have kindness, who are compassionate, who do have good values, who are able to be responsive in innovative ways, who are not trapped by conventional wisdom.
In response to those who say there's no substitute for experience, in a way there is a substitute for experience.
Well, and nobody is experienced.
Genius is a substitute for experience.
Ah, that. Yeah. There is genius here, isn't there?
Oh, I think so.
And it's more than he's a good writer.
I think so. Absolutely. He seems to have seen a distance farther than other people could see. Whether he saw the war, the end of the war, emancipation, his own death, you know, he was a haunted person and he haunted other people in his sense of foreboding and this seeming unsurpassed knowledge of what was to be.
And it never stopped him.
Never stopped him. No, it never stopped him.
This notion of genius, I found myself reading this, and it's easy in modern times to think that, you know, they are sort of quaint because they're historical figures and we have all this technology and we have what it passes for news 24 hours a day and we think we're very well informed. And I kept finding myself being very impressed at the quality of the journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say it was, you know, perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but the quality of the writing in many cases... The quality of the reporting in many cases stands up. You know, it was much more partisan than those days.
Oh, I don't know.
Well,
it was
maybe.
Pretty, it was It was openly partisan.
Yeah. The newspapers had essentially a party.
Democratic or Republican papers.
But many of the politicians, the words, the thinking, and Lincoln, of course, at the center of it. But it forced me to stop diminishing the competence. Right. Just from a historical perspective, these people would be functional today. Some of them would be much, much better. I mean, you know, where's Lincoln when we need him? We hope he's somewhere around. But the quality across the board of many of these people, I was you know, just to see it, to hear it was to me very striking.
And that's another piece of advice in my bullet point list. Make yourself accessible. You have to pass the test of being, it's not so much a vetting, but being exposed and being natural in front of people who are not automatically your supporters. When Henry Villard came to Springfield, and he was the, quote, embedded reporter, a term we didn't really have then, in Springfield, Illinois for months, he came from the New York Herald, which was a Democratic-leaning paper that had supported Stephen A. Douglas. It's the equivalent, I guess, of Sean Hannity knocking on Barack Obama's door and saying, may I spend 3 months in your office? And I don't think anybody would say yes to that today. It's a little unreasonable, but Lincoln said yes. And Villard at first said he was uncouth and seems overwhelmed. Little by little, those reports sensed that there was something growing in Lincoln. And though he wasn't privy to the private decisions, to all of the cabinet discussions, he got to see him under pressure with office seekers taunting him. And he really took a different measure of the man. And the pieces were syndicated. So from that point of view, Lincoln had it down about how to make himself better known and better respected.
Well, you also point out how regularly he attends to newspapermen. Obviously, his mm-hmm. understanding of the media.
He loved newspapers and loved newspapermen and hung out in newspaper offices. And when he was really wanted to get his point across, he didn't trust anybody to write the editorial. He wrote it himself.
Harold Holzer.
In the third person.
In the third person. Mr. Lincoln.
And then it got leaked.
Right.
Harold Holzer is with us, and so is Abraham Lincoln and a lot of other people. We'll return in just a moment to continue the conversation.